died before he could see 2012.
Was it? Why did he want to see 2012?
Well, he had a theory called Time Wave Zero.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I love this. You know
and,
everything.
He had done something with the I Ching and psilocybin mushrooms, okay. Where he had developed a mathematical theorem which was supposedly supposed to map time. And according to his theory, time would actually end, or history would end, in 2012.
Well, this is after the Mayan calendar or something.
Well, it happened to coincide with that, but okay. It actually was based, I think, on the I Ching and his trip to the Amazon in 1970.
And he lived on a... Yeah, and this is it. See, he's talking about the end of the world. This is Terrence McKenna.
Yeah, Terrence McKenna.
Did you listen to this stuff? You know what this
I listened
is?
To Terrence McKenna for years in the early 90s. I've read a few of his books.
Oh, for God's sake.
And I thought he was brilliant. Probably a charlatan, but... Brilliant, nonetheless.
Well, he lived on the island, the Hawaiian Islands.
He did.
Did he die of a drug overdose? Or
no, no. He developed brain cancer.
Too many bad drugs.
He asked his doctors if it could have been, you know, all the drug use. And they said, no, based on what he had told them he had taken, which was mostly organic plants, I guess.
Uh-huh.
They said probably it just was bad luck, but he got a very rare kind of... Brain.
Bad luck.
Yeah, very bad.
There is no bad luck in the universe.
Well,
no,
okay. You know, doctors.
No, but Doug Lane, L-A-I-N.
L-A-I-N.
And your book is from what press?
It's from Nightshade Books, which is a San Francisco and Portland-based small press, or indie press, as they like to call it.
And it's available at Powell's. Okay, we're going to get into it. They're long stories, but they're so... I have a trouble. No, it's Terrence McKenna in the background. Do you know this record then?
No, turn it up.
No, I'll turn it up for a sec, just for a second. Ooh, it's rave. Talk about it.
Oh, wow. Well, see, I don't think Terrence did the musical part.
There it is. It's, well, is that his voice in the background, maybe?
Yeah, it must be his voice.
Eclipse Side and Solar Side. I think we're doing Shaman... Shamania, maybe. I don't know. There, read it. A lot of the youngins, my young friend. Yeah, there we go.
Shamania. Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's go.
This is when he was...
Jealous. Yeah.
He was getting particularly popular, I guess, and would do just about anything.
Oh, and there's the title on the other side. I can't read it. Zubia.
Zubia and Terrence McKenna. Yeah. Didn't Noam Chomsky do this as well? He's part of some rave or something.
No.
I'm sure he did.
Noam Chomsky is one of the straightest dudes in the world.
I know, totally. But
he's one of the dullest and smartest devils on the planet.
They took his lectures. Actually, I've always wanted to write a short story called Noam Chomsky and the Magic Mushroom.
Well, why would you do that? Why would you pick on Noam Chomsky? Go
well, ahead. Because I think... I love Noam Chomsky. I'm a huge fan.
Well, pick on him. Go ahead.
But I think that Terrence McKenna and Noam Chomsky really ought to have at one time debated, because they were both concerned about the same issues, but they had such completely
different... Well, what are those issues? Let's keep going here.
Well, the issues were that... what did Terrence say? Terrence said that history would either end in green... Basically, with the psilocybin mushroom or with the nuclear mushroom, the nuclear.
And now that's a poetic metaphor. This
right.
is a poetry program.
Right.
This is great. Keep going.
I like this. And so, McKenna saw us as a, you know, a very oppressive political culture, one that was verging on fascist. I think he would say that. And Chomsky has a similar vision, but you couldn't. But otherwise, they have nothing in common at all. I actually wrote...
No,
to,
they don't have anything in common.
No, nothing.
Chomsky's MIT is very thorough.
Right.
He's a scholar. He's a Western mind.
Right, absolutely. And
minutia, details. He believes in details.
In 1991, I had a magazine I was doing called Diet Soap, and I wrote to Noam Chomsky asking him if he thought that in order to overcome capitalism and the...
Diet Soap,
we needed to maybe consider mystical states. And psychedelic drugs as a way to overcome our programming. And I wanted to ask Terrence McKenna if he thought that we could achieve anything without a real revolution and without real political activism. I wanted to ask Terrence McKenna what the kinds of things that Chomsky was advocating. I wanted to ask Terrence McKenna about. Because I saw them as two sides of the same countercultural coin of 60s radicalism and leftist thought in America, but it's like Terrence McKenna, the totally pop culture, mystic, drugged out hippie, and on the same era, the new left, you know, Mario Savio, Noam Chomsky, marching on Washington, D.C.
Where do you go to college?
I went to PSU.
Oh, Jesus, so did I. You're so smart.
That's where I met him.
Oh, you met him at Dan. Chime in here. You met him at Dan Shea.
Well, I was reading the Vanguard. Doug was opinion editor there, you know, and there was this young kid that was writing some interesting stuff, and I decided I was going to go introduce myself.
I'll bring this down. We'll come back to Terrence McKenna in a minute. But yeah, keep going.
Yeah, because I was interested in young people that were had a political mind and wanted to make a difference in this world. And but when I met him, though, there was this article that he was writing. I got up there, and actually it was Bob Black.
I was running Bob Black articles in the Vanguard. Bob Black is an anarchist, I think out of California, Berkeley. But he, being an anarchist, none of his essays are copywritten, and you can print them at will. And so I was in the Vanguard's opinion section, but the production crew one week decided to put my name at the top of Bob Black's article. Not that I asked them to, but
and you got a bunch of fans that way.
People said that was the best thing you've ever written, Doug. Of course, I didn't write a word of it.
Well,
that was the one on work on how.
Now, what years were you there? So actually, let's give a big shout out to Portland State University. It has really grown. I remember I was there in the 19. I graduated in 66, but I hung around Rubens 5 and the anti-war community, and when we had major strikes against the Vietnam War, and we're trying to have same thing against the Iraqi war here, and but Portland State has never slowed down, and actually my young friend gave me that record, and he's in China now. Michael's in China, and they have a Mandarin program at Portland State. I mean, Portland State is really becoming a major urban university, and it has never lost its radicalism. I saw Joe Uris there, who teaches there, and I used to remember when he gave Fidel Castro kinds of lectures in the 1960s, and really I respect Portland State, and it still continues. So tell me a little, is Education Without Borders, Dan Shea, S-H-E-A-A, there? And you just came back from Vietnam with the Veterans for Peace. But
that's right.
But are there connections there at
Well, through Portland State, actually, I was a co-founder of Students for Unity, which is...
Students for Unity, go ahead.
You know, here's a great organization that continues to... be involved in the political discussions that are going on, and they raise rallies and bring in speakers like Noam Chomsky and others, Michael Parenti. I was also the co-founder of the Multicultural Center at Portland State. These were the kinds of activities we were doing while on campus, and I was one of my colleagues was a professor and mentor of mine was Abdi Hassan, who was a Somalian who. And, you know, when he went back to his country, he came back, and when he came back, he and I got together and said, how do we carry this on outside of the university? So we came together and we created Education Without Borders. And Education Without Borders was one of our first projects, was to actually get donations of books, and we sent them over to Africa in Somaliland, in northern Somalia, where they were just now starting to rebuild their country after a number of civil wars. And that after the Civil War, they had destroyed all the infrastructure, and they were just beginning to open up colleges and schools. And so we sent, about 10,000, 15,000 books over there.
Well, you know, you've been to Venezuela and also recently Vietnam, and you're going to read something. But let's get back to this in a second. But Doug Lane, is this your first book, Apocalypse?
Last week's Apocalypse.
And now what that
is my first book.
Now what that seems to me is, and I want you to read, the stories are long. Which one do you want to read? The sea monkey thing blew me away.
Yeah.
And
I'm writing a novel based on that, actually.
Oh, no, I could see why you would. It got me going. But I thought we might read, you might read some sections of it. I think we need your voice on here. I think we need to read something. But
okay.
Which one would you pick? Do you want to pick
Shopping at the End of the World is what I've been reading.
Oh, and there's some Portland references in here. I saw Lloyd Center, Thomas... Lauderdale. Right. So what does this mean?
Do you want me to set up what the story is about?
Well, just a little bit, but you can read. Yeah, set it up just a few sentences.
It's about a guy who works at a fictional version of the Urban Outfitters who discovers a shredding machine in the store. And I got the idea when I was reading about the font Helvetica and how pervasive it is. I think it was Naomi Klein who wrote about that and how it's the symbol or it's the font of authority is Helvetica. And I thought, what if you shredded that font? So in any case, this guy finds a shredding machine, which when you shred things, the implied promise in the thing that you shred will be, start to affect reality. And all it will shred is advertisements, brochures, advertisements, glossy magazines. But it won't shred anything else. And so these things start to impact the mall, Lloyd Center Mall, and also just the world or Portland. And I can read from it if you
want. Yeah, let's read 3 or 4 minutes from it just to get us a feeling for your work. Because Doug Lane, L-A-I-N, and what's the name of the...
The book is Last Week's Apocalypse.
And from what press?
Nightshade Books.
Nightshade, and it's available. Okay.
Yeah, it's available in stores and Amazon.com and all that kind of stuff.
Let's get a sense of the book.
Okay, so this is towards the end of Shopping at the End of the World. And I'll just go. The Lloyd Center was packed. A feeding frenzy was underway with massive, chaotic lines pouring out of every shop and department store. "Hey," said a businessman wearing blue sneakers and a white Oxford cloth shirt, "you work at that hot dog place, don't you?" "Sometimes," Sadie said. "The lemonade is tainted. It's full of isotopes or something," he said. And then he downed the cup of yellow liquid he was holding without pausing to breathe. And it went on like that. Waves of paranoid complaints circled through the crowd, only to be followed by absurd displays of gluttony. And the explosions increased in number to create a strobe effect. "There's no more oxy. I want 15 double espressos and 12 lattes to go. What is that strange purple mist in the penguins wearing sunglasses window display? Will it affect the lenses?" A mushroom cloud and a moment of silent deafness. "I need today's and yesterday's Times. The newspaper is very important to me. Do you have Kelly's canned pork brains and gravy?" A flash and then a roar. "Where are they? Where are the girl power action figures?" A massive explosion and then another. The mall was ground zero, an endless stream of mushroom clouds. No space, no time in between the blasts, but just a long white field of light, a deafening roar of atomic wind without pause. And then silence. 30 seconds of silence before the world came back. The lines of people, the storefronts and plastic tables, all of it came back into view, and then the rioting continued. The screaming, the looting, and the violence began in earnest. And then the Lloyd Center Mall began to disintegrate. It started to burn without making smoke.
Oh, my God. Okay, choose another one. These are the titles. Your books are so. Where did you learn to think like this? I mean, we're not gonna, don't tell the cops or anybody.
Okay, well,
cranking the wheel of reality.
Well, I've read Terrence McKenna.
Okay. Music Lessons, The Subliminal Sun.
The Subliminal Sun, yeah.
I read the last one, The Headline Trick. Yeah. I mean, in your work is postmodernism, paranoia, the dead celebrity.
Yeah.
How to Stop Selling Jesus, which I
haven't read. Oh, that's a great one, too.
Is that good? Yeah, we'll dip into that. But the identity is a construct. You know, my young friend was telling me this. Maybe we'll turn Terrence McKenna back on for that. He was telling me that someday when we're wired to the computers, we'll just our memories and everything, our personality and everything will be in the machine. Is that true?
I don't know. I would think it's probably not
possible. And you'll never die. You'll be immortal because you're...
But we'll run out of oil and the machines will turn off.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, he's wrong on that one. But, I mean, no, wet wiring, biological neurons to, electronic, stuff in a computer or a CD disc.
I think these are the fantasies that are sold to us by the corporations.
Well, the kids believe this. I mean, they believe that, and I don't know if they like it. But they think... Oh, you think they're fantasies.
I think they're the fantasies sold to us by the corporation.
I want you guys to be political. Dan,
because,
get in this.
Because I think that...
Well, what Microsoft sells is.
What they want to tell you is, if you hook in deep enough, you'll find some meaning.
That's what I want to hear,
But the fact is, this is all bullshit. The entire corporate culture is about an inch deep, and it will never fulfill you. You will not be immortal. You will not find the perfect orgasm. Not online, anyway. And
maybe you can plug into Line and it'll be lined into your hormonal neurological system and you will get a virtual orgasm. Are you saying you can't?
I'm just saying that if
you can't. I think
you can.
Yeah, you can.
You don't think you can?
Yeah, of course
I think you can. But it will be any good.
Of course you can. You can jerk off with anything, and that's what they want you to do: is sit home, jerk off with your computer.
That's what they want. Yeah.
Yeah. Stay indoors. Don't worry about the fact that it's getting warmer. Don't worry about the fact that we're running out of oil. Don't worry about the fact that the President of the United States has said that he might use a nuclear bomb on Iran.
Yeah.
Don't
be
worry.
Happy. Don't
be
worry.
Happy or plugged in or, as superficial as possible. And I think that it's very dangerous. And at the same time, I'm on the computer about 8 hours a day.
You are?
So, yeah.
Why?
At work.
We don't give your work number away. We don't have any trouble with the boss.
I'm supposed to be on the computer, but I can also go online. And so it's not like I don't use the internet or anything. I'm not a Luddite, but I don't think it's some saving thing.
Well, but I want to know about this. Is the human race becoming... I didn't write in your wrong note. Is the human race becoming wired to the web?
Are we in the matrix?
Yeah, but the
Dan, respond. I don't
have. Well, that's one of the things that, as you read Doug's stories, that you get.
Yeah, tell him about Doug's stories.
I finally get this feeling. Of course, like you said, the paranoia. But it's like. Everybody is in this sort of dream state, and they go through these surrealistic...
Yeah, it's a psychological thing that's been laid over us. Yeah.
But he's trying to say, wake up, come on, figure it out, We're all in this dream state. It's all an illusion. The whole capitalist system is an illusion, and we need to change the system. We need to change ourselves. We need to wake up to what's going on in the
room. Wake up.
Who is that?
Terrence McGinnis. No, it's crazy crap. I like it. It's goofy. It's rage.
The revolution will not be televised.
Okay, let's stop it. Okay. So, Doug, get another one. Selling Jesus.
Another one? Selling Jesus?
I want to hear your voice. We know.
All right.
And then we're going to bring Dan in here. He went to Vietnam. But I know.
Let's see.
So where will your book be at? And Roger Weaver, if you're awake out there, you call in at 10:30. Okay.
Okay, so you want me to read?
Which one do you want? Pick one.
Okay, so I can just read from How to Stop Selling Jesus, which is about...
What does that mean?
It's written in the second person. Is what it means, but it. It's about a Bible salesman in the future, near future, who goes door to door selling virtual reality versions of the Bible.
Oh my God!
And so you can step inside the Bible and play out the parts of different people.
Oh!
And but this one goes on
Buckler
the fritz.
Orange.
Well, Jesus doesn't do what he's supposed to do.
Well, come on, man! You're hip. This is really hip writing. This is very good writing.
Let's see. So I'll read this scene that's, again, towards the end, because I want, something big.
Give us a big scene.
And it's called Turn On Your Bible. And
oh, God, no. I mean, no one calling. No, I'm not going
to. So what happens is the salesman ends up having to take the place of Christ. Turn on your Bible. Are you the king of the Jews? Pontius Pilate asked. He is sitting above you in the mezzanine of the Colosseum. He's shouting down to you, but you don't shout back. All around, a crowd of Israelites, your people, are yelling for blood. Crucify him! Are you the son of sons, the king of kings? Pilate shouts the question down. Pause, program. The scene stops. Pilate freezes in place, and the crowd of Pharisees and peasants stand still. You can't go through with it. Recalibrate the subject of as Pontius Pilate. You instruct the computer, meaning you want to be Pontius Pilate. Resume. Crucify him, your people shout. They are still your people. Pontius Pilate is still above you, although now he's walking down to the edge of the balcony, moving closer so he won't have to shout. Flog him, Pilate says. Pause program. But the simulation keeps running. Your arms and legs are held tight, stretched by two Roman guards. The whip comes down hard and quick on your back, and tiny hooks on the straps dig in. Your flesh opens. One stroke. Pause program! Pause! You shout. Two strokes. Three. Four. This isn't real. It's simulation. It's a simulation, you scream. You shake your head back and forth, rock back and forth against the pull of the guards. Try to fling the VR headset from your scalp. One of the Roman guards walks up to you and grabs your face as you scream in pain. It's me, he says. Jesus? The guard nods slowly and then leans in toward you and whispers, my mistake was dying for other people. What is that? You start to ask, but the whip comes down hard, tearing you open again and again. Make it stop. People have to die for their own sins. Ordinary people have to escape the karmic cycle under their own steam. I can't keep carrying this load for them, Jesus tells you, and then he steps back and disappears into the crowd. The pain is terrible. The flogging is over, but there is wind in your back, along your spine. You are wounded. Are you the king of the Jews? Pilate asks. The Colosseum is jammed, flooded with people. Not just peasants and Pharisees now, but accountants, insurance salesmen, telemarketers, construction workers, legal assistants, secretaries, and so on. The people are calling for more blood. Crucify him! Are you the king of the Jews? Pilate asks. That's what everyone thinks, you reply. Run your fingers back and forth through your hair. Meticulously hunt down the metal strap of the headset. It isn't there. Pilate reaches into his robes and pulls out a holographic postcard, a kitschy flip card that switches back and forth as he turns it in the sun.
It's trippy, man. This is trippy stuff.
First, there is a projection of a white bread Jesus bowing in prayer.
Oh, God.
And then there is an image of the enlightened Christ. The second Christ looks off to the side, his chest open and glowing red, his heart ringed by thorns and topped by a flaming cross. Do you understand what this is a symbol for? Pilate asks. He turns the card back and forth, so the image keeps changing. That's Jesus, you reply, before and then after the crucifixion. Wrong, Pilate says. This is a picture of the human condition. First we see a man caught up in psychological time, caught up in the world and all the things he wants to achieve, to become. And then we see what it is to be outside of time, to give up becoming, to give up being, in order to have a totally open heart and mind, Pilate says. Do you see it? He flips the card back and forth. Jesus staring, Jesus praying, Jesus staring, Jesus praying, back and forth. I still see Jesus, you tell him. Crucify him!
Wait a minute. You often divide your the plot lines of your story into multiple choices. Where the hell did you learn this from in college? Is that what
it's
an interesting trick. You have that short story called... on a scale of 1 to 3.
Right, right.
Now, we're going to go to that in a minute. Let's go to that in a minute.
Okay.
But why do you, you know, so is this a computer kind of
in the
turning
Jesus?
Literature into a multiple choice text or something? Or
well,
what?
We have choices.
1 to 3? It's a personality
okay,
test.
Go ahead. Okay, keep talking.
And it's also the story of a kid who takes a trip to Los Alamos to see where the first bomb was.
Yeah, and the radioactive pellets are lying on the ground. You don't pick them up, so it's become a tourist site.
Yeah, that's right.
Where did you learn all this subversive information about the postmodern world, the you know the virtual world, the newspeak of the media and everything? Did you get turned on to this stuff? I mean, what? You're a political animal, but
I dropped
hanging
out
with Dan Shea.
Yeah, that's part of it. I dropped out of college. I went to Eckerd College, which is mentioned in
that's
the book.
A real college. You're
that's
using real names.
That's
I like
real
that.
Name. And I went, and then I came to Portland, and what happened was the Gulf War. And
Eckerd College is about the first Gulf War. Okay, keep talking.
Yeah, and the Gulf War.
Those Apatises were those first things.
Well, it was the Gulf War. The Gulf War. When I was about 20. I'm 35 now.
Okay.
It was such a shock. I mean, I was already pretty liberal. I mean, I grew up in Colorado Springs, and that's a very conservative town. So by that standard, I was a communist, but I was just a Democrat there. but I moved to Portland, and there was a war that was obviously manufactured about to take place, and I was shocked and frightened about it. Again, the nuclear threat was involved at that point. That also hung over my head. I grew up in the shadow of NORAD.
Well, that's never gone away. I hate to tell you that.
I know.
It's still happening.
So, and, So I think it was just moving here, seeing that Gulf War, being appalled by that, dropping in and out of college, working for environmental groups and nonprofit groups and things.
Well, you know, some of these things could be turned into you know, movie skits. This is an interesting book, The Dead Celebrity, The Suburbs of the Citadel of Thought. The I mean, this the headline trick. What's that about?
The headline trick is about
a
magician.
I'll interview you.
That he takes headlines and he inserts them into ATM machines.
Okay.
And gets back cash. So the worse the headline is, the more money he gets. And it's actually been a trick that's been passed down through his family for generations. They started with safety deposit boxes, but now they do it with ATM machines and headlines. But the problem is...
This is what the Oregonian does with their headings on their stories.
Well, it's the stock market, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's the worse the news is, the more money these fuckers make.
Right on, man.
The thing that's happening in this story is that he's not getting very much cash back because the news is too bad. I mean, you can only push it so far.
People will turn away from really.
And even the ATM machine just doesn't want to respond to the Bush administration's war and.
Okay, I'll jump to 203. I read the news today. A ghost story. What do you mean a ghost story?
Okay. Well, there.
Well, that's you're using a Beatles riff. You know, I heard the news today, but I mean,
read the news today is actually. Yeah,
yeah, but you're saying that the ordinary news that we get out of the newspaper ain't read. Oh, and there's John Lennon.
Yeah, that was my novel attempt. That's a novella.
Oh, it's huge. I know we can't do it. I wanted to get a feeling for it, though.
Right. Well, I read the news today was about a nuclear war, and that's the first thing he reads is that there was a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, and it's like On the Beach. You ever seen the movie?
Neville Shute, On the Beach. That was a big in the 50s, early 60s.
So it's like we're in the United States waiting for the radiation, and we're living our lives as if nothing's happening, but we're being haunted by ourselves in this story. There are ghosts in the story, but they're just the people we want to be or that we're not going to get to be because of the nuclear war or because of the global warming or because of the fact that they are watching what we read and we're hiding. You know, that's what I read the news today is about.
I'm telling Roger Weaver that he's going to call in at 10:30. Now we're not. Maybe he won't call in. Maybe he fell asleep again. I had this happen before, but it's all right. We'll see what happens.
What's he going to do when he comes?
Oh, he's just going to read a couple of poems from his book. That's all. But you know,
that's all.
Identity is a construct.
Yes.
And other sentences. Who am I? I'm an identity construct. Now, is this surreal, or do you think that I look human, or it's just literature? But in fact, I am a simulacrum. What is a simulacrum? I'm a
simulation.
I'm a simulation of myself.
Yeah.
My job is to evaluate, deconstruct, and finally encapsulate the texts of human culture. And I am not alone. There are thousands of identity constructs all over the ship. But who am I? I don't know who I am. I am an identity construct. I wonder if I might be something else, somebody else. Do you think people feel anxious in the modern world here? Roger Weaver, call in, and otherwise going to keep talking. I really ought to quit smoking. Well, that's a funny line. That's a throwaway. You know, that's a funny line. But the computer wants an explanation. What is an error? I'm experiencing a lapse. Do you require maintenance? No, it's just that I'm sure that I believe in myself. I'm not sure I believe in myself anymore. I'm an unconvinced of my I. It seems to be just another word. I. You're suffering from identity degradation, maybe. You're constantly working on assimilating late 20th century literary theory. You will switch modes and proceed to early 20th century movies. Do you think that will help? Yeah, and it will adopt a new name in addition to your number. A name? Your number is Jack. Jack/0435-21. Thank you. The star culture one.
Culture one.
Most, okay, what's go ahead. Talk about it.
Okay, well, have you ever read Borges?
Well, yeah, of course.
The Library of Babel.
Okay, this is the Library
of Babel. So I just rewrote it. That's all that is. But, no, it's a great story. And, but this is, I put it on a spaceship, and maybe it's a little bit more my own.
Well, it's more like, 2001, you know, what's his name?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Kubrick.
Yeah, Kubrick.
The movie. Then Arthur C. Clarke, of course.
And Arthur C. Clarke,
right. He wrote the
Do you read story. These kinds of people, Arthur C. Clarke?
Oh, yeah. I read.
What's some of your background literature? You, Borges, Arthur
Borges,
C. Clarke?
I like, yeah. Philip K. Dick is the guy. That's
yeah,
the
he's scary. I remember I read Camp Concentration when I was very young.
Thomas Dish. That's not Philip
Dick. Oh, that's Thomas Dick. Okay, help me. Straighten me out.
That's all right. And who was a good friend of Philip K. Dick? Thomas Dish and Philip K. Dick.
Why should we read these guys? I mean,
because you should read Philip K. Dick because his books are better than the movies they're making based on his books, and because...
Which are a couple. Give me a couple names.
Okay. There's one coming out, which... Blade Runner is the one...
Oh, the Blade Runner is the famous one.
Yeah, that's the one. Then there was one, The Minority Report, that Spielberg did.
Minority Report. That was a Philip K. Dick story.
Yeah, that was. There are a couple others that they made. Most of them, Screamers is based on a short story of his. Most of them are not particularly good. Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger is a Philip K. Dick.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a recall.
Yeah, right.
Identity construct.
Right, yeah. They're making these movies based on his books and his short stories, but he was probably the Kafka of our generation.
Okay. Philip K. Dick. Yeah. Philip K. Dick. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I should probably not mention him so much because I get compared to him a lot, and it's like...
No, we all have mentors, people we learn from, we read so-and-so.
I like Kurt Vonnegut quite a bit. I've read a lot of different people. This story, Identity's Construct,
If Roger Weaver calls in, he can, and I'll be watching the phone. But let's, okay. Now, last week's apocalypse, is that sort of saying that the title of your book, Douglas Lane, from Shadow, what?
Nightshade
Books. It's sort of like the media... the political culture, they never have any happy news in the newspaper, do they? No, there's always they keep wanting to stimulate our adrenal glands toward terror, horror,
fear,
and we should be so goddamn happy that we live in a safe, happy. Culture like the United States of America with Homeland Security and the Bush administration and Donald Rumsfeld about ready to move on Iran and deconstruct the energy cycles of the planet when gas is going up to $3 and it will go to $4 if they bomb Iran. It will go to $5. So anyway, but the title of your book is sort of like this isn't so much the end of the world, though all of us talked privately about this before we walked into the studio. It is a possibility. But last week's apocalypse means, what, the headline fear-mongering?
Why last week?
Well, see, the way I look at it is that we're growing used to the terminal spiral destruction we're in, so that there's an apocalypse every week, and it doesn't surprise us.
And so when the real one comes,
it's real now, folks. Uh-oh. I mean, it's happening now.
Okay.
It's just that, you know, we're not, we're okay with it.
It's still the frog in the water.
That's
right?
Basically it.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. This is the frog in the lukewarm water that goes to boiling point, and the frog doesn't notice because things.
Yeah, right. Or it's even worse than that because we're like cognizant, really, mostly. I don't think most people are in very effective denial about how bad things are.
Well, but, you know, remember, in capitalism, this kind of capitalism, and I'm really coming down on capitalism hard. I'm sorry. I just don't like it. I think it's really a mistake. It's a bad ideology. It's a bad...
But money, it's free money, markets.
No, money-making is a bad religion. I'm really opposed to it. I'd almost prefer Christianity, though they did link up at some point. I guess that's what I've heard about Protestantism and stuff. But anyway, I would rather say that why do we all have to work so hard? I thought technology was going to give us more free time.
That's right.
And I thought we'd all be covered, you know, because the robots would be doing the hard, dirty work, and right. the rest of us could just kind of lean back and relax, and, you know.
Well, they just fired half the people.
I'm going to bring you in, Dan Shea, into the conversation. What happened? They fired whom?
Well, I mean, half the people, when technology did reduce the work labor of a lot of production,
yeah, right.
they fired the other people. You were supposed to be able to take the workday to become smaller and to have more free time and keep people employed.
And thank God the longshoremen on the West Coast wouldn't put up with it, because they were going to replace many of those guys. And they said, no, we'll shut the docks down. Sorry.
Well, just look what just happened to the New York transit strike. You know, here these people were fighting
for
their pension.
Did they win?
They won the pension, but the leader, Chersant, transit striker, goes to jail today. He was being
10 days in jail. Yeah, that's
days
right.
In jail.
KBOO has great news, and I listen to Amy Goodwin and 11 a.m. Democracy Now. I mean, Toussaint got 10 days in jail, but I think he has to stand up. I think people have
that's
to stand.
What he's saying. Well, people have to stand up, and labor, it shows the power of labor. And we have May Day coming up shortly. And this is going to be about the immigration.
Well, yeah,
issues,
what are you guys going to do here soon? And I want to talk about your Vietnam trip. Now, we're going to come back to your book.
Okay, great.
And you're going to read a couple more passages. I want us to read. And you're going to read something. What are you going to read? Now, you went to Vietnam with Veterans for Peace.
With Veterans for Peace and the...
Just when? Give me the dates.
I left. The conference was in Vietnam in Hanoi on... March 29th, 28th and 29th. There was a two-day conference, and we spent some time after that.
You'd felt guilty.
I feel
guilty. I didn't even go to war. I feel guilty. I feel guilty. When you show me that...
The pictures of those kids
ruined by Agent Orange.
What we have to talk about is that, you know, when we look at about this, wars do not end when bombs stop falling.
No, they don't.
You know, when we cease fighting, its devastation continues long after the land and the mines and the bodies of the affected
population. I think industrial capitalism is war.
Today there's like 3
you don't need a war.
3 million Vietnamese that suffer from chemical defoilants. You know, they want to call it, you know, defoilants as though we're just spraying our grass and poisoning the weeds.
Yeah, yeah.
But in fact, this was extremely toxic dioxin that was at greater strength than it's ever used on your plants.
Millions of pounds of it.
The thing that's really important about what Dan did is that after Vietnam. What? How long after Vietnam?
35 years later. You know. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about
today. Today
we're
the same thing is going
on with depleted uranium. But what I wanted to say is, like, I went to Vietnam in 1968. I was there. I was trained to be a killer. I operated a machine of weapons of mass destruction. It was an M60 machine gun. I was fortunate I never had to use my weapon. I was there for about 3 months. My brother came over and he had signed a waiver to stay there. 2 brothers weren't supposed to be serving at the same time. I was sent home. But I was affected by, I saw people that were killed. I was sniper fires and booby traps. But one day is too many days in a war zone. One death is too many to see. And the idea that I came home about 4 months later, my brother was one of 18 people left alive. He came back to the U.S. in a straitjacket, and he suffered many, many years and is now waiting for a liver transplant.
Agent Orange got him, too.
Yes.
Agent Orange got him.
The war got him. Post-traumatic stress got him. There are many outcomes. When I came back, all I wanted to do was live in peace, to forget about all these things that were going on. I found a young woman I fell in love with, Arlene, my wife, who I'll be married to now in June 16th, for 35 years. We had 2 children. My first son was Casey Allen Shea. My daughter was born 14 months later, Harmony Alexandra. She just got married last year, and she's doing fine. But my son was born, when he was born, it should have been the most joyous day of my life, but it wasn't. He was born with a congenital heart disease, with a cleft palate, and other stomach abnormalities. He had a seizure, and immediately after that seizure, they put him under special care, and we were afraid for his life. And we spent our years dealing with the problems that he had. 3 years, about the age of 3 years, in 1981, he had to go for heart surgery. And in that surgery, there was an oxygen shock to the brain. He went into a coma for 7 weeks. 7 weeks we were at his bedside. until the day that he took his last breath and died in my arms. Well, there was an epiphany
it's
that happened to me.
It's a lot of suffering.
It's a lot of suffering. And what I went through this sort of epiphany, you know, I knew that my son had this disease that maybe they could help medically if we'd put money towards health care. But, you know, what was it? I went through this thing thinking about what happened in Vietnam. And the first thing I thought of when my son was born was Agent Orange. At that time, they were denying that there were any effects from Agent Orange. Then I thought about, you know, how can we pay tax dollars to make bullets and bombs and chemicals to kill other people's children? And I decided from that day on I would dedicate my life towards peace. And one of the
You've done a great note, Dan Shea, Education Without Borders and Veterans for Peace. You have done amazing work. You were in Venezuela, mm-hmm. and you're going to read something from your recent trip to Vietnam. But I didn't mean to interrupt you. What I'm saying is, well, what year was that you decided to dedicate your life to turn the world around?
Well, that was in 1981 when my son died.
Oh, my God. You know? 25 years ago. Yeah. You've done this job. Well, I give you a big hand
Thank
of applause.
You.
And
well, the thing is that, you know, over the years I was involved in a lot of different political activism. The Central American conflict was going on. But what happened here is that when we go, let's get back to right now. I went to Venezuela, right?
Yeah.
I went to Venezuela. I was invited to go down there and paint a mural in solidarity with the Bente Traicionero. I painted a mural, which was the mural of
the faces of fascism.
So I painted that down there. At the same time, Mr. Danger, Mr. Bush, was accusing Chavez
Hugo
of being
Chavez,
fascist. I had painted the mural from my painting, the new faces of fascism, of Hitler, Mussolini, Bush, and Hitler. So that is now in the barrio.
If you go to
www.ewobusa.com,
you can actually
see
find
that.
This
Doug,
painting.
Repeat that again slowly.
It's ewobusa.com.
.org.
Okay.
Yeah. ewobusa.org.
.org.
And
that's ewobusa.org.
And that means Education Without Borders. So.
Yeah. And you can see his paintings.
That's right.
Well,
That was a great opportunity. I was also there to be on a panel as a veteran for peace with Pablo Paredes, who is a conscientious objector. I have done a number of things that deal with issues of war. But I was invited. We brought some people out from – we had brought Vietnamese victims to Portland State, actually, December 4th of last year. And while they were there, they told their stories. And then I had told my story. And they heard it, and they invited me to come to Vietnam to be a part of this Agent Orange conference that I went to. And when I went there, we had five veterans from the U.S. that were affected by Agent Orange. There were people from Korea, the Koreans who had were affected by Agent Orange when they were there, Australians and New Zealanders. There were some people from Canada and a number of scientists from around the world. That were there.
Agent Orange was created by Dow Chemical.
They're
giving
right.
us other things
and
right
we have,
now.
And, Vietnamese have a lawsuit against the Dow Chemical, the Monsanto, actually. They
or
have
Monsanto,
a,
excuse
and
me.
They have
is it Monsanto or Dow?
I think it's both, but the lawsuit is against these people right now. And what happened is that they lost in the lower courts, and there's going to be another court appeal here coming up in May. And what we wanted to do is get out the information about this and have this conference and make a call to the world.
Well, we had to be clear. Actually, you know what? I may be wrong. Dow was napalm. Was that? Monsanto maybe. Okay.
Yeah.
That information, we're not picking on one or the other, but they were involved. Both of those companies were involved in poisoning the landscape. And I think that, I'm going to say it slowly, capitalism is war.
That's right.
Yeah. War is fueled by capitalist industrial interests, and capitalism, in the most poetic manner you can think of, is an attack, an aggressive attack on
all of us.
Traditional lifestyle, upon the environment, upon the ecosystem, and upon the very viability of the planet itself, because capitalism, like a virus, only intends to eat the host. And we are the host, the workers, the environment, you know. And so capitalism operates, corporations operate on a war mode.
This is a class war, and it's life and death.
Well, I want people to know about the movie I just saw, Why We Fight, and it explains very clearly how the arms merchants use the stock market and all of that to make profits. And they bring out new brands of missiles, just like they bring out new brands of automobiles or TVs.
It's like the play Major Barbara, remember that?
Oh, with Major Barbara. Well, he was a great man.
Bernard Shaw.
What's his first name? Bernard. Was it Bernard Shaw? Okay. I'm keeping William Bernard Shaw, but no. I was able at Wordstock to hear Gore Vidal, and he praised Oregon's William Appleman Williams, who was the first.
And Chomsky, too.
I'm sure Chomsky was involved, but William Appleman Williams was from, I think they were saying University of Oregon. I don't know if it was Oregon State University, but I'm only going back in a feeble brain. But anyway, to analyze the American Empire.
Right.
To analyze the American Empire. And it's a real field of study, and it's a really true thing. And we citizens of the empire must begin to turn it around or throw our wooden shoes.
Well, let me read you.
Yeah, go ahead. Something.
I wanted to say when I was there at the conference, one of the things is that I told my story, as I did other people.
Okay.
This was printed in the papers, and there was a young woman who had read the story a number of people came up to me, and they were saying that they had read the story, and they had tears in their eyes, and they were asking me, you know, saying that they were sorry for my loss. Well, I shed many tears for all the lives that were lost there. And then in the newspaper, this young woman wrote a piece to the court to be sent out to the U.S. and around the world.
Well, you read that for us. We got to keep reading. This is not a talking heads program.
She wrote, "Dear Court, you know how many Vietnamese poor and unlearned women who were born or have been living in the region that the U.S. troops sprayed toxic chemicals during the war and could not understand the chemical structures that had and the impact of the dioxin? They only can lament their fates. When they delivered children born with deformities, some thought that they themselves and their family members did something wrong in the past. So now they have to suffer the negative consequences under the laws of casualty. This is their Buddhist beliefs." Now, one of the things that she says is that some of these women went mad because of the great misery, while others committed suicide to escape from their miserable lives. And many of the women have still tried to do their best to earn money to bring up their disabled children. "Dear Court, the fates of the Agent Orange victims are very miserable, too. They cannot talk or walk or do any of the normal things that normal people do. They cannot derive even the smallest joys from their childhood." And she writes that she decided to bring together a circus and a little play for these kids. And when she was there in this village called Peace Village, which was started by a Vietnam veteran.
City? Saigon?
This is in Hanoi.
Hanoi, okay.
And that all of our disabled, she was saying that she was talking about and describing that, but what she gets down to, that one of the children, after they had performed this performance, that all of a sudden there was no sound that you usually hear. There's clapping or joy. It was quiet. And then all of a sudden, some child would start hitting his chest because he only had one arm. Another would start stomping his foot because he only had feet and no arms. Another would scream because he had no arms and no legs. And she was holding this one child, and the child says to her, "Auntie, would you just scratch my head? I have an itch." And when she said she scratched his head, but tears came down her eyes. And that's what she wants people to realize. These are real lives. These are real people. And these stories go on every day. And this is the third generation of children affected by
the third generation since.
And they're looking at it.
The Vietnam War, which actually helped nothing in the world, which has been seen as a failure even by the Defense Department and military generals. And
what's the life expectancy of DU now? And what are the lives? We're going to be talking about this 35 years later with this war. We need to connect the dots between Asian and
we Americans have a terrible karma on the planet, and God knows what will happen. The misery and the military aggression that the United States of America has thrust out upon the unwitting world, it is really an incredibly horrific burden. I think we will be, if you believe in Buddhism and you believe in karma and causality, I think it will, we will be paid back in some horrible way. And maybe we are. Maybe our people are soulless. Maybe we have lost our souls. So Dan Shea, Education Without Borders, your murals on, you know, in Venezuela. Are you going to talk about this? You got slides. You did a beautiful slideshow at WordStock the other day.
I want to talk about WordStock and
I want you to, and I want you to read another piece.
I want to talk about art.
Find a piece. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it just seems like, you know,
we're
soulless.
Out of time. We have 7 minutes. Yeah.
And we've got terrible karma, but you know, you can do things to try to change.
Well, it's not our karma. I didn't do it.
Yeah. Right. Well, right. But it is our karma. But
well,
it's human.
Collectively.
It's
just,
this is
mean,
it. You know, this is what humans are like. But
will literature help change it?
Well, that's what I was going to say.
That's
is like,
question,
you know,
right?
You're doing this show. Yesterday we were all together trying to do something that might make a difference at WordStock. I've got this book, and it doesn't seem like much but an ego piece most of the time.
No, it's a great book. It's a very interesting style. I just want to recommend Last Week's Apocalypse by Doug Lane. It's a very fascinating. It's a rich, it's a big, fat, wonderful book, and, you know, I think it could be turned into a movie.
Well, parts of it, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's fun. It's really an interesting read because it's postmodern. It's the young people who use computers can read this book and really trip out on it, and they can learn a lot about cultural and political history. It's a very good book, Doug Lane, L-A-I-N. Okay.
Thank you.
Keep
thanks,
talking. I'll follow up on your thought.
Well, my thought was just this, that beyond just doing these artistic things that if we
is
need
there
to...
Is an avant-garde?
Well, we need to try to change things, and I think that people like yourself and like Dan and other people who are like Gore Vidal are doing what they can, and we just need to
I think it does make a difference
in the face of this.
Yeah, there are people listening out here, and they want us to stay on track, and we are staying on track because we're in the crossroads of history. This apocalypse thing is no joke. The Oregonian printed an article, God forbid, I mean every other horror story they can come up. There are, what are they called, methane... Rocks,
oh God!
Methane burps.
Yeah, from the ocean.
And if the ocean
like
warms up to and methane is 20 times more heat producing than carbon dioxide.
Right.
And if the ocean gets warm, there will be billions of pounds.
Well, if we're gonna die tomorrow, let's make this a better world. Stop cooperating.
Yeah, let's not worry
with
about dying. Everyone will die.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
eventually.
That's
right.
Yeah, there's no problem.
Let's just change this damn world right now.
Right.
You know, don't cooperate with them. On May Day, they're asking people in the for
tell
a general strike.
Tell us about
strike.
May Day. When's May Day coming? What day? Come on, help
May,
us.
May 1st.
The May Day.
No,
but
what,
is it Monday or what day is it?
I think it is a Monday, I believe. I'm not sure.
Don't go to work on May 1st.
Don't go to work. Don't buy anything.
The secret sayings.
If you're going to do anything, come out to the rally in Portland.
The secret sayings of Jesus. You know, the Gnostic gospel, I know people.
I love this.
Oh, man, I love it. You are the light of the world. I think it means each one of us. We are the light of the world. If we think, your whole body will be luminous. If you light, the light which is within you is darkness, how great. But if the light within shines out, I mean, the Gospel of Thomas is really trippy. I'm on Jesus' side with this one. No prophet is acceptable in his village. No physician heals those who know him. Jesus said, a city built on a high mountain, fortified, cannot... Well, I think it can fall. What you hear in your ear, preach to another ear upon the roofs, for no one lights a lamp. Anyway, the point is, we're lighting a lamp here tonight, and Doug, it is impossible for anyone to go into the house of a strong man and to take it by force unless he binds his hands. Then he will plunder his house. We're going to plunder the White House. I'm sorry, we said that anyway.
Yeah, well.
Okay, guys, where are we going? We got four minutes.
Four minutes.
Well, so are you going to read something or what?
You want me to read something?
Let me just say that
people can get involved in Veterans for Peace. They can just they can call 503-282-5015. Or they can check out the national website, www.veteransforpeace.org. You don't have to be a veteran to join.
That's Marvin, and that's
we're all veterans.
Who are those guys? Marvin and I love
Dave
those
Klein and a number of people. The international vet. Marvin is of the Northwest Veterans for Peace, and I'm with Veterans for Peace Chapter 72.
Right on. Well, I'm glad to have you here. Dan Shea, S-H-E-A-A, Educating Without Borders and Veterans for Peace. And Doug Lane, are you going to read from your book? Why don't you read out as we go out?
Okay,
here?
All right.
Well, I'll bring down Terrence McKenna. We don't.
Okay, so you
I
want me to read?
I hate rave music.
Okay.
I'm already raving. I don't need this.
Yeah. That was great.
We're already raving.
Yeah, I wish there was more Terrence and less of the music. But
Okay.
I was going to read from the 84 Regress, which is...
Well, it's a huge thing. You're talking about the Reagan era. You got
to talk about Reagan era. It's 1984.
You got 2.5 minutes. Okay.
And I'll just start, and then, why don't you just cut me off slowly or something?
Well, we'll cut you off.
All right. All right. So this is the 84 Regress, and its first part is called Life in the 80s. Life in the 80s isn't all bad. Television, for instance, is better than you might remember it being. There are fewer stations, fewer commercials, and everything is slowed down. There aren't ATMs or fax machines. There aren't any email messages. Driving on the interstate, counting the yellow dashes that zoom by, it all makes sense. The last 16 years were just a series of bizarre nightmares. Everything was just as unreal as it felt, and the year 1984 never ended. Let me repeat that.
It never ended, you're right.
The year 1984 never ended. It's my own unified field theory. Generation X, the Clinton presidency... Jay Leno, my relationships with women, all of it makes sense now. So should I keep going?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
All right. So the next part is called The Breakup. Cindy and I broke up in 2001. The problem was that Cindy didn't know how to argue, or more to the point, she didn't know how to sublimate. She'd been through therapy, just like everyone else, and she took her medication, but she could never stick to the issue at hand. I'd start in about how she squeezed the toothpaste tube or complain about her haircut, but she always tried to figure out what was really going on. You don't care about my haircut. You just don't want to marry me, she said. She didn't understand how the game was supposed to be played. It's your hair. It's your hair. I know you don't understand, but it really is your hair. She looked great, actually. Her hair was fine, but when she stood there looking at herself in the mirror in her mother's wedding dress... And with her hair pulled back and her tan face shining, suddenly I couldn't stand her. I took my pill. I took my pink pill and smiled. You should try on the tuxedo, she said. I can't. Because of your hair. Cindy and I broke up. We broke up because she didn't know how to argue.
Doug Lane, your book is an endless loop. Last week's Apocalypse Now. I'm going to get out of the Apocalypse? No, just Apocalypse.
Last week's Apocalypse.
Okay. Thank you for being on the Talking Earth. Dan Shea, you guys take care. Terrence McKenna, adios.
Tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.